it, so I was using regular deodorant for a little bit. And
did that undo everything?
No, it worked way better.
I gotta make the deodorant commitment. I do.
Okay.
All right. Well, hello and welcome.
Welcome to today's episode of Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teenie.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite things in the world.
Alcoholic beverages. So today we are exploring the dark underbelly of the booze industry. Mm. True crime, that hot shit.
It is so hot right now. That's really funny you say that. So obviously we decided we jump on that true crime bandwagon.
This is totally
so interesting though. It was just like, I see why it's a craze. Like as we were researching this, it just really drew me in.
Yeah, I'm one of those people, I have like a love-hate relationship with true crime because I feel a little bad about like enjoying it so much.
I hear that.
But I was really inspired by, you know, our ladies over at Wine and Crime Podcast.
Oh, heck yeah.
I feel a kinship to them, and it's basically the only true crime podcast I listen to. I know a lot of people like My Favorite Murder. Mm. I'm a huge fan of like Making a Murderer.
That's funny because what brought me to them was wine.
Who?
The true crime gals.
Oh, yeah.
So on, as we said, today's episode, we're going to explore a case of guile and misdeeds, each related to beer and wine. I can't wait to hear what you've got. These are a lot of fun to research.
It's going to be good.
but before I start to spin my tail, Teenie, what you drinking?
I today am drinking, fittingly, Dead Guy Ale by Rogue Brewery. I think it's Rogue Ales and Spirits. Oregon, from Ty Valley, Oregon. There's definitely a dead guy in my story, so that's why this seemed to fit perfectly.
Yeah, spoiler alert. I'm just kidding. Teaser.
But as far as the composition of the beer, this is a German Maibock, and it's made with several different types of malt, including Turo and some Munich hops, or some Munich malt. But what I really find interesting is it's made with several malts made on Rogue's own farm out in Ty Valley, Oregon, which is about an hour and a half east of Portland.
Yeah.
They're one of the only breweries like in the country that has the land and the latitude to actually grow most of their own ingredients.
Wow. That's
so
neat.
Their farms, I guess they have two farms in Independence and Ty Valley, Oregon. They grow more than a dozen ingredients for their beers, spirits, ciders, and sodas, including 10 varieties of hops, 2 varieties of malted barley, both of which are in this beer, rye, pumpkins, marionberries, jalapenos, and some honey. That is really cool. They do all of that out in Oregon. This is, I think, a brewery on my bucket list to go visit one day.
Yeah, that sounds just like Oregon. Going above and beyond.
Yeah, totally. And then in addition to their own malts in here, they also have a proprietary strain of yeast called the Pac-Man yeast.
They're all over it.
Yeah. It's a 6.8 ABV beer with 40 IBUs, so it's going to be pretty roasty.
Yeah.
Maibock is synonymous with Hellerbach.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm getting a little deep into the beer here, but it's a German lager with a bigger hop presence.
Okay.
So this is going to be malty, grainy, sweet, and it also has a little bit of what's known as Maillard reaction. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Did not nail it.
Yeah.
Maillard reaction, and that refers to a chemical process that browns in terms of the color, flavor, and aroma. So it's like the same thing that happens when you char a steak.
Yum.
Or like burgers.
Baked bread, maybe. Yeah. Ooh, do you mind if I smell it?
No, totally. So you'll get that. It's imparted by the malt.
Ugh, it's not the mart.
Because of the degree to which it has been roasted. So,
yum.
Laura, now that I'm done talking about my box. last note. My also means May. So that is typically when these are drunk in the spring.
Neat.
So we're a little early, but that's okay. Laura, enough about me. What you drinking?
Well, I also tried to pick an appropriate brand to enjoy today for our true crime episode. So I chose one of 19 Crimes wines.
Ooh.
Yeah, I chose Red Blend. They're just Red Blend because the sommelier in the store said it was their just go-to, most bought one.
Okay, so that's not
they make
very
other
specific.
Varietals. Yeah, it's, you know, they make other varietals, but this one was just a red blend from Southern Australia. So 19 Crimes is a brand of wine that caught a lot of attention in 2017 with its augmented reality app.
Oh my gosh, I've heard of this.
Yes. So they have 19 different labels that each feature a mugshot of a criminal. And
are these like real criminals?
Yeah, as far as I know, I'm assuming, like, maybe it's just a big marketing thing, but I'm pretty sure these are real stories about real people.
It'd be harder to just, like, listener make up mail, 19 stories.
Yeah, send me an email if I'm wrong. So an augmented reality app, and it lets you interact with the label, and it you scan the label, and the person on it tells you a story, like, a little bit about themselves.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah, here, I'm going to see if I can get a little bit of the audio while I do it real quick.
Do it. Should you first explain who this guy is or, like, what he looks like?
Okay. So the guy specifically on this bottle is a story about a man named John Boyle O'Reilly. And he was young. He was, like, 18. And he was convicted of crimes against the crown, like so many young Irishmen of the time. Mm. And all he was doing was fighting for the independence of Ireland, like any good Irish person would be. Okay. So he's a cutie, though. He's got shaved head, I'm sure, because he's being shipped off on a convict ship. Let's see if we can have him tell a little bit about himself.
The spirit of a rogue sustains when the bars of man impede. For no cage can hold that which is boundless. No man stop that which is fated to be.
Oh my gosh. Like, how terribly romantic, right? Oh my God. So, yes, this man specifically was remembered because during his whole trial and shipment and conviction and all that, he wrote poetries. Like, there's so many great Irish writers. And then he escaped these penal colonies and escaped to America. So God bless you, Mr. O'Reilly. And I just wanted to say I am so happy I picked this one up because I just happen to be especially passionate about the Irish independence. And I was actually...
and you were just in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. It all seems really relevant to my like life right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Cheers to Mr. O'Reilly.
Cheers to you, sir. Here. Oh,
what era was he from?
Let's see. That was in, I want to say, like, 1770s, maybe, around there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, around the penal colonies.
Good times. Yeah, good times.
Yeah, a couple hundred years ago.
Back in the day.
So, let's get into this. We're each highlighting a case of crime committed within the booze industry.
Yes, and I could not be more excited to hear about what you're about to talk about. It's salacious. It's effervescent. Yes.
And it kind of, not kind of, it did rock the wine world. So what I am going to tell for you today is a story of wine fraud and counterfeiting on quite a large scale featuring Mr. Rudy Kernaiwan. So.
Okay.
Let's set the scene.
Is he our main character?
He is. He's our main character in this. So setting the scene in America, for a long time, we were not drinking good wine. We talked about this in other episodes about just prohibition really decimating the whole industry, taking a long time to get back in. And from the 50s to the 70s, people were drinking a lot of like jugs of Rhine and ports and fortified wines.
Yeah.
And then throughout the mid-century, taste started to change. And then in the 70s, California makes a huge splash in the international wine scene in a blind judging referred to as a judgment of Paris, and which we referred to in the California episode. And then all of a sudden, wine in America starts getting really good, you know?
And does it actually start getting good or it just starts getting really coveted?
A little bit of both. That's interesting you asked that. So, okay, enter the 80s when everyone is doing Chardonnay and cocaine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about Chardonnay and cocaine. And there's this like element of old American money meeting new stock money. And there's this lavish excessiveness that rolls into the 90s with more new money as these dot-com millionaires and billionaires suddenly start living a fabulous life. And because of that, these really fine wines from relatively small regions like Burgundy, France, these regions can't produce enough to meet global demands for the rich and elite. And wine auction houses start to pop up in the 90s where just filthy rich people can bid exorbitant amounts of money for really rare wines.
Yeah, like more money than like I will ever see
shake
in my
a
lifetime.
Stick at. Yeah. It's like this is not somewhere we're going to hang out on a regular basis, probably you and me.
Yeah, no, we can pretend.
Yeah.
And stand outside. I'll like pretend to write an article about it so we can get in and see it one day.
Yeah, I'll definitely go as a plus one. Please do.
It'll be like a societal feature.
So keep moving forward into the early aughts, early 2000s. And
good times.
Yeah, good times. There's this young geeky guy in his 20s, and he starts showing up to these auctions and to some pretty prominent dinners, spending extravagant amounts of money.
Oh, yeah?
His name is Rudy Krnayawan. And he's a misdeer. Yeah, you can maybe nail
what was his name?
Rudy Krnayawan. Yeah.
Nailed it.
And he's like a literal mystery man because no one knows where he's from, who his family is, how he's so filthy, stinking rich.
Yeah.
And he's spending, I mean, he catches attention because he's spending unheard of amounts of money. He's spending around $1 million a month in these auctions.
So, oh, just like in total, it's not like, hey, $150 and he's like $10,000.
No, I mean, he's buying $1 million of wine a month from these auction houses.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, to have $1 million to spend on wine a month.
I know.
I mean, I do that regularly, like, but to have,
God,
like,
y'all.
The actual budget.
And so the rumor kind of was that his family was a distributor of beer to Indonesia, and they were just so wealthy and so rich that they gave him a $1 million a month wine allowance for him to, like, play with.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So that was the rumor playing around. And Rudy really begins to wine and dine all of these major players in the auction and fine wine scene and really starts to build their trust. Some of these guys are like Robert Parker, who is a renowned wine critic, Jeffrey Levy, who is a Hollywood film producer and avid wine collector and kind of all around gross guy, if I'm my humble opinion over here.
They're just like enamored with
this
dude.
They just love him. They're so charmed. He gets in their inner circle, this group called the 12 Angry Men, who do these like insane dinners where they spend like on just wine alone, $200,000 a dinner on like wine alone. You know what I mean? Just like,
can we like stop for a second and ask, why are these men so fucking angry?
I don't know.
They're
what
they're getting mad about.
They're
dining
the
for.
Because they're just old white men, and old white men are fucking angry.
So was the dude.
Oh my God, everything's too good. Like, how could it be any better?
So stressful being so, like,
white,
stable
and white.
Yeah.
Oh God. Okay, so you're already picking up on this, like, vein of
these fucking poo nannies, soft shell crabs.
And just aside from being charming, and I mean, he's buying and selling and drinking so much of this wine. Like, he's buying this fabulous wine and he's drinking it with these guys. And in 2006, one of the oldest auction houses in the U.S., Acker, Merrill, and Condit, on 1 year alone in 2006, they sell $35 million worth of his wine in an auction.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he's taken, you imagine, $1 million a month, $12 million, and he's turning around and turning it into $35 million in that same year.
That's crazy.
Right.
Probably because he himself was inflating the value of that wine.
That's a really another great point that you pick up on. I was going to go into later. Like, literally, with Burgundy so small, he's buying $12 million worth of a year, controlling all of it, and then selling it back on the market at a higher price and just, like, making bukus of money, which a lot of, not it's not just him, a lot of rich people were investing, air quotes, in wine in this way.
Yeah.
So,
it's actually kind of smart.
It is. If you have that kind of play money, fucking why not?
Yeah.
So, and just in his prime, you know, he was well loved not only for his charisma, but he had a great palate. He was super generous, sharing all this, like, really fine wine with these people.
Yeah, it's so. Like, hey, what do you think of this guy? I'm like, well, he has really great wine, and I'm drunk when I'm around him.
Yeah, so it's a pretty good time, if I'm not going to lie.
He's intoxicating.
Yeah. But then in 2008, 2 years after that massive sale with the auction house, things begin to unravel for Rudy.
Oh, poor little Rudy, who we don't know where he's from.
A couple things happen. Two pretty important things happen for this story. First, some of Rudy's ultra-rare wines appear in an auction in New York at Crew, a restaurant, that were supposedly authenticated by some of, quote, Burgundy's most discerning experts.
Okay.
Okay, so one of the wines in the auction from Rudy's cellar was a Domaine Ponsat Clos de Saint-Denis from the years 1945, 1949, and 66. So over in France, Laurent Ponsat of the Domaine Ponsat family sees a catalog for auction with his wine in it, and he says, wait a minute, we did not start making that wine until 1982. Like, these wines are completely fake. Like, these wines don't even exist. This isn't a thing.
Like, 1940, that's false.
Yeah, that is verified false.
1940 false.
Yes, exactly. So
that's amazing.
These wines are fake. And so what does he do? He flies from Burgundy all the way to New York and shows up at the auction. And the auction is being led by this auctioneer named John Capon. Mm-hmm. And he's of the Acker, Merrill, and Condit Action House.
Okay. So, so like the people who are supposed to verify that this is
right,
real.
Right, exactly. So again, who does this responsibility lie on? So John Capon is like the 90s bad boy of wine. His tasting notes for wine are always comparing them to like fine sex or like call girls. And he's always promising bidders in these auctions that they're going to get laid if they buy this like next lot up for bid.
So like, would you compare him to like the Kid Rock of
wine? I don't
know.
He's kind of gross. I mean, kind of the 90s and the heydays, like before Me Too like hit, where people were just being like ultra gross.
Yeah, okay, so...
you know?
Yeah.
Is that a weird... Is that a fair thing
I'm
to say?
I'm just looking for, like a an American comparison.
I mean, he's American. John Capon is...
Oh,
this
God.
Is in America. This is in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, he's just a gross New York dude. Being all gross.
Meh. Okay.
Meh. So, anyway, is Laurent Ponsant's fake wines, not his wines, the fake ones, come up for bid... And Ponsant stands up in the back of the room and yells across the crowd, take my wines out of this auction. And John Capon is like totally flustered. It causes a wild buzz in the wine scene. And then Ponsant confronts Capon after the auction to find out where this fake wine came from.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, where the heck did you get this swill? I have to protect the honor of like Burgundy and like the reputation. Like, where did this come from? So John Capon gives him Rudy Kernoyon's name because they came from his cellar.
Ooh.
Yes.
Totally just rats him out.
Oh, well, I mean, it's just like, and also like, yeah, if these are like hugely fake, let me know. Because we just sold like almost $40 million worth of swine like a year or two ago. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, if this is fake, this is going to be fucking Schitt's Creek for us.
Oh, my
too.
Gosh.
So and then a second thing happens as well. The second thing has to do, God, I always mispronounce their name, with the... Koch brothers? Koch brothers?
Coke.
Yeah, Coke.
I got it.
I know I don't mean to be cute. I'm not trying to like say they're cocks or anything. I just like really honestly don't know how to pronounce their name because I always see it written. So the Koch brothers, Koch brothers. The two main ones I think are like David and Charles. But this story takes place with the third oddball, Bill.
Oh, Bill.
Good
old Bill.
So a few years earlier, Bill, who is an eccentric man and an avid wine collector, he buys 4 bottles of spectacularly fake wine.
Mm. What do you mean spectacularly fake? That is beautiful.
I mean, they are just like as fake as you can get. So they are bottles, supposedly, from around 1730, owned by Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson was a huge lover of French wine.
Mm.
And he paid $100,000 a bottle for them, totaling $400,000.
That person needs to, they need a financial
advisor.
And
it wasn't just him. A lot of other wealthy elite did the same thing as well.
That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You really think you're buying Thomas Jefferson's wine?
They want to believe it. And odds are they probably won't ever open it. And that's why fake wine kind of like really,
yeah,
because it's like collector edition stuff, really rare stuff that you probably wouldn't drink on most occasions. So,
yeah, it's like art.
He finds out these are fake, right? And he's like, Bill Coke is consumed, is consumed with this, like, you're going to cheat me? Like, mentality. You think you're going to cheat me?
Me?
Yeah. So, because he was cheated out of $400,000, he proceeded to spend $35 million on investigating and scourging out the fake wine in his cellar.
That makes total financial sense.
Like,
what?
Again, that's what I'm saying. It got maybe borderline on a little obsessive for him on his part.
God.
Also, like, shit. Like, you have $35 million to, like, throw at this problem.
Right.
I have a few problems if you can.
It was only a $4 million problem.
$400,000. It was not even $4 million. It was $400,000.
Yeah.
It was less than half of $1 million.
I guess.
So, anyways. So, this might be a really great time to mention his estate, where this wine is. This is a sprawling, underground, chandelier-lit cellar that holds somewhere between, depending on which interview you look at with him, between 20 to 40,000 bottles of wine.
Is that?
Wow.
Yeah. And it's in his multi-million dollar mansion in Palm Spring, which happens, by the way, to be filled with ungodly amounts of fine art and masterpieces. Like, his brothers joke that his house is a museum. Like, he just collects things, fine art, cars, rare wine. Because
money to blow.
Yeah. So he spent years hiring private investigators, retired CIA agents, cork experts, glue analysts, label decoders, and even a retired counterfeiter to fine comb his collection. And he found he had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on fake wines, like so much. But a whopping 400 bottles of the fake wines he found all came from Rudy Kernielwan's cellar. So then all of a sudden, he starts knocking on Rudy's door, asking some questions.
Hey, Rudy.
Yeah. Exactly. And so Brad Goldstein, Bill Koch's private investigator, starts to build a case against Rudy.
Going down.
Yeah, you know, sir.
That's why you don't fuck with rich people, dude. Uh-huh. They have the money to, like, figure that kind of shit out.
Yeah.
And the time.
Yeah, and the time. The time is important,
sure.
too. So as this case builds, Goldstein cannot seem to confirm any information about Rudy or his past. There's no wealthy trading family. There's no trust fund payments like he claimed. There's just, like, pretty much no family at all. Rudy claimed he got his wine from that was in Bill's cellar, that he claimed he got it from an Indonesian wine trader. But when Goldstein followed up with the man, he did not exist. And the phone numbers that Rudy had given him belonged to Lion Air, which is an airline there, and to a strip mall in Jakarta. So,
sweet.
Yeah.
That's where I keep all of my wine connects.
Yeah.
Private strip mall in Indonesia.
Yeah, this is the ultra rare one. So as he dug further, Goldstein dug further, he realized Rudy was actually on an expired student visa and had been deported in the past from America. He also managed to track down that two of his uncles stole hundreds of millions of dollars from the Indonesian bank on an inside job and then fled the country, one to China, one to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So he just comes from a real, like, crimey
family.
Yeah. And side story, he also, Goldstein, uncovered that his uncle owned the strip mall that the phone number was, like, given to him of, too.
That's just, amazing.
Yeah. Just being cute.
Being cute.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Yeah, of course.
Have I seen a movie about this?
Maybe. There is a documentary called Sour Grapes.
I've seen that documentary.
Yes,
I was like, this is all sounding really familiar.
Yeah, and there's also a really great podcast from Stuff You Should Know chronicling all of this as well. There's, I'm sure, a lot of...
So it was that historic.
Oh, this was historic.
This was unprecedented.
Unprecedented, the scale in which this happened.
He was the biggest wine criminal.
But as far as Rudy is concerned, one of the most interesting things about him maybe is that his name wasn't actually Rudy. Rudy at all. Rudy Kernielwan was a famous Indonesian badminton player, and his real name was Zin Wang Huang. Zin Wang Huang. Something like that. Hopefully, yeah.
Nail it.
So they finally built this case, and then in 2012, cops busted in his door. Well, actually, they started to bust in it, but he came and answered it in his boxers. I was like, oh, I'm sleepy.
I'm sorry. Who's there?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Also,
were you trying to get in?
They didn't try to Google his name first to see if it was anyone famous.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of people in Indonesia. I'm sure there's a lot of people with that name.
Maybe. But, like, you'd think if there were a famous tennis player, then maybe.
Yeah. So, anywho, when they get into his apartment, they find some fascinating things. They find several bags of aged corks. They find stacks of printed wine labels. They find recipes for faking famous vintages of French wines. They find stocks of empty bottles and old wine bottles with labels being removed and soaked. Pretty much a plethora of wine counterfeiting supplies.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
Surely none of those things are related.
So, long or the short of it is, he was the very first person in the U.S. to ever be convicted of wine fraud, and he is currently serving a 10-year sentence in California.
10 years!
10 years. And, it did receive a lot of attention because it is the most large scale. And his reach went so far. So this is considered to be the largest scale wine counterfeiting operation known to date. Not only did he make fake wine, he also played the market like we talked about earlier, where he would buy up all of one, drive up the price, drink the good stuff, replace it with the fake, and put it back on the market and sell it for like 10 times as much.
Oh, gosh. That's when I stole vodka from my parents and like tried to fill it back up with water.
It's just like play on play on play. In addition, our friend Laurent Ponsant actually did the math, though, about how much time it would take to create as many counterfeit bottles as he did. And he really doesn't believe Rudy acted alone. He believes there was a whole operation because just the sheer manpower and the hours it would take to pull off what he did, there's got to be someone else involved.
He have like an estimate for numbers? So like
I think he said it would take one person working 24 hours a day for over 2 years to create the number of
counterfeit
wines. In the, you know, tens of thousands.
And he was like drinking and wining and dining people. Obviously, that takes time out of your day.
Oh, totally. Yeah. But to be honest, fake wines, counterfeit wines happen pretty often. So some things, if you happen to be a millionaire looking to buy some rare and fine wines, some things to ask you,
our demographic that we're going for.
Some things to ask yourself if you're buying that is, do the wine labels and the caps and corks match as far as age and wear? Is the glass and glue used correct for the time? And does the label have any typos? Because that's probably a pretty glaring. And does that wine actually exist in this world? Did the winery actually make that wine?
Yeah. Okay, so if we could take that list and just, like, reverse it.
Yeah. That'd probably be a good place to start.
Does this wine exist? Is the... I can't remember that one.
Oh, God. And so remember, though, from episode one of Grapes and Grain, that people have been faking wine for centuries. And that's actually why the controlled region, like the DOCs in Italy and the AOCs and AVAs were created to protect the integrity of the region and label.
So he was just like the number one American undervaluing wine.
Yes. And like I mentioned earlier, all this is chronicled in Netflix documentary Sour Grapes.
Where is he today?
He is in the prison in California. I'm not sure which city or which prison, but he's still there. And he has declined every request for interviews. No one knows anything about him. That's the thing. Even with this, all the stories done, no one knows who he is or where he's from or like
what
the motivation was. Like, he won't talk to anyone.
Well, Indonesia. His uncle owned the thing in Indonesia.
Right. And so I think they're just like in a pretty crimey family and, you know. But anyways... Oh, that's in the documentary.
I can't decide if 10 years is a lot or a little.
I know.
For that crime.
Okay.
It seems a little for the amount of money.
Well, it does. But let me maybe see if this next point skews your opinion a little bit about how much time he's serving. It's a pretty neat documentary. But one of the very off-putting things about the documentary is how it brings to light how obnoxiously rich the upper echelon is. And this was occurring while as a country we were struggling in the mid to late 2000s during our financial recession.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this was when we graduated college. We couldn't find jobs. Yeah. Everyone was getting laid off. It was just a shit show. And meanwhile, Bill Koch is spending $35 million to track down his like fake wines. And
people
they're
are getting
having $200,000 wine dinners. And these guys are
people
just
are
like
getting foreclosed on.
Holy shit. These guys are just untouched by it.
What a juxtaposition.
Yeah. So I wanted to wrap up with a few quotes from the documentary that were just doozies for me. The first two I have are from just the rich people themselves. The first one is that really gross Hollywood producer has a friend, a buddy that he's riding with in the car, and they're drinking their wines in their car with their driver. And he says to the camera, buy 96 champagne all day. If you can't get 96, buy 02. And if you can't afford that, then fucking drink beer. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, okay. So many things to unpack there. Another quote was from the producer guy who said, have a few drinks and want to spend $100,000 on wine? This store is the place. This store is the place for
this
you.
This store is the place?
Yeah.
What store was that? Not like I could even fucking touch anything in that store.
Literally, the New York article I was reading said this boys club enophiles come across as a bunch of tone deaf hedonists, and that could not be truer. But I do want to say also, like, shame on them, because there is footage in this documentary of Rudy in these dinners and at these auctions because there was a pilot shot in 2002 for maybe a food and wine show about him.
Ooh, yeah.
So they have like a whole pilot's worth of like footage of him schmoozing with these guys. And here are some quotes from Rudy that are just like
beyond this world.
Yeah. So he says, I'm an expert in fake wines, you know, because I buy so much of it. At an auction, he says, comments, wow, that bottle just sold for that much. I just opened and drank one of those last Thursday. Can I, like, refill it and stick a cork in it?
Oh, this is, like, a classic case of, like, right in front of your fucking face.
Yeah,
like,
and the last one is my favorite. In a dinner with all these guys, someone says, hey, Rudy, what do you do? And he says, me? I'm broke. I scam people. Yeah. So
I'll cheers
that
to that.
Is the story of Rudy Pernilion.
Oh,
you did the thing. So I get it. Lying, stealing, cheating, it's wrong. However, I'm going to reserve my stores of sympathy, maybe for like others in the ultra rich willing to buy fake wines.
Like, who was really suffering in this situation?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know? Who did this crime hurt? And I know crime is wrong, but that's my take on that.
All right. Well, that was amazing. I need to decompress. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love creating this show for you, and we hope that you guys enjoy listening to it too.
That's right. And if you're a retailer or a producer and would like to have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment,
What You Drinkin'?
Send us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain at gmail.com.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution to help us keep doing this.
Cheers, y'all. All right, we're coming back from the break. This is it. We're back from the break.
All right.
Whew, all serious here. So, thank you for listening to my tale about Mr. Rudy and his wine counterfeiting escapades.
Yeah, what a friggin' scam artist. What a
mastermind, really.
Rascal. He's a real rascal.
A
real rascal.
What have you brought us for us today?
This next tale is less about scamming and more about crime and murder.
Oh, gosh.
And they do have one thing in common. There is a large amount of money involved.
All right.
So
rich and famous.
Yes. The subject of my case, his name is Adolf Coors III.
Okay.
And if that name sounds familiar, he was the grandson of the founder of Coors Brewing and heir to the Coors Brewing Empire.
Gotcha. But wow, it's that Coors.
Yes, that Coors. So the grandson of the beer tycoon. So let's rewind a little bit.
Okay. So set the scene for me.
Yes. Let's start with the founding of the Coors Brewery. So this is a company that goes back to 1873.
Oh,
it was founded in Golden, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Out west, Adolf Sr., he had immigrated to the United States about a decade before.
Okay.
And was 26 years old when he opened the brewery.
Wow, good for him.
Yes. So 20 years later, they were winning awards at the Chicago World Fair, and they were the only brewery west of the Mississippi to do so. So
that's
a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
And Adolf III was born January 1916 to his parents, Adolf Coors II and May Kistler Coors. And that was the same year that Prohibition hit Colorado.
Oh, wow.
So this is really interesting. I actually found most of the information from this case on the FBI government website.
Yeah.
And so traditionally we think of Prohibition hitting in 1919.
Yeah.
But apparently Colorado, which is one of the least regulated states today, adopted it three years early.
Yeah. Can I also just say that if you have to be named Adolf, this is a good time in history to do so.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. I mean, it was a really popular name back then. The co-founders of Anheuser-Busch, they were Adolphus. And that was one of their legacy names in addition to Augustus. But because these are all German immigrants who basically started the nationwide brewing scene, it was a name that immigrated with them.
Totes. Okay.
So the brewery in Golden, Colorado, however, is able to survive because they are also making porcelain, things like sugar bowls and tea sets. And they're also making malted milk. So while there is no...
Malted milk sounds yummy.
Yeah. Does it, though?
Yeah. I don't know. This malty milk. Like a milkshake or something is what I think of. Is that not what it is?
No, that sounds actually spot on.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Malted milk on and of itself, I'm just like, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like. So they were able to survive. And by 1955, the brewery, it reopened after Prohibition, and it is making 1 million barrels of beer in production and sales per year. So they are straight killing it by 1955.
Yeah, going strong, yeah.
Absolutely. So apparently...
But Americans drink.
Yeah. And apparently it was not that rare for the heirs to such kinds of fortunes to be kidnapped in exchange for a ransom,
of
money.
So bold. Who would try to pull that off? What a caper.
It wasn't even rare for beer heirs. The president of Ham Brewing Company was reportedly kidnapped by a gang in 1933. And even Adolf Coors Jr., this guy's dad, had been the target for a kidnapping, but police broke it up.
So who's kidnapping them? Is it like international gangs? Is it like your local thugs?
Anyone looking to make money.
A buck. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but our subject today, however, he was not so lucky to get caught by the police. According to the FBI's website, which again, I'm just like shocked that this case is featured there. Like, rarely do you get to cite such a crazy source for a story.
Yeah.
Anyway. According to the FBI's website, remnants of foul play were discovered by a milkman on January 9th, 1960. Apparently, there was just just a car stopped in the middle of the road.
That's a very creepy and suspicious.
Yeah. And after honking, the milkman got out and discovered no one was in it.
Even creepier.
Well, he didn't obviously think he was that creepy. He was focused on work because he politely just moves the car to the side of the road.
Oh, he just like drives it over or?
Yeah. And then he calls the police and is like, hey, there's an abandoned car.
Oh, that's a very sensible way to handle this.
Especially considering he did mention that he saw some reddish stains on the car. And there was a hat by the river where the car was abandoned.
Oh my gosh, that is so... So once you saw the blood, maybe you're like, maybe I shouldn't put my fingerprints all over this.
I don't think that in 1960, white people probably weren't worried about anything.
Yeah, well, that also. I was thinking of fingerprint technology was even there, but that too. Yeah.
So the police, after being told about this car, they identified it as Adolf Coors III.
Was it like a fancy car then?
Well, I'm not sure, but he was 45 years old, and he was a father to four kiddos, and he was really well known in the community. So as far as they could tell from the car, he just disappeared. Ugh. So they send out a search party.
Okay. That's also a sensible thing to do.
Yeah. And so the next day, January 10th, his wife, Mary, gets a ransom note.
Like, is it handwritten or is it like cut up magazine letters, like, you know, pasted it?
I'm not sure. It's some sort of ransom. Actually, it was written on a typewriter.
Oh, okay.
I know that for a fact.
Okay.
And the note says, give us money. Give us $500,000.
Whoa, that's
and you'll
a lot
get your
of money.
Husband back. Yeah. This is 1960.
Yeah.
So Mary, with the help of law enforcement, follows the kidnapper's directions, but she never hears from him. And the police follow her and it ends up being a dead end.
Oh, no.
So no work from the ransom note. She's like, fuck. I was willing to pay you $500,000,
buddy. Here it is. I'll pay double. Husband back.
After that didn't work, the police, they go looking for other leads and decide to pursue what's described as a canary yellow Mercury
car. Sounds flashy.
Yeah.
Flashy and fun.
Apparently it had been seen in the area. But that lead also doesn't manifest much luck.
Gotcha.
So this happens in January. In September of that same year, a couple of hikers come across some clothing.
It's always the hikers.
Yeah. In a town south of Denver, they're hiking in Sedalia.
I love it. I'm beautiful.
Sure. We'll just say that's how it's pronounced. Most importantly, they come across a pair of trousers with a key ring with the initials ACIII. So
AC3,
a doll.
Baby.
Adolf Coors III.
Yeah.
They also found some skeletal remains that were determined to be Adolf's. So he had been shot, according to what they discovered here at this crime scene, he had been shot twice from behind.
It's like execution style.
Yeah.
Wow.
They were upset.
So after they found all of that evidence, the police decide to publicize the one lead that they had to see if it led to anything. That car, the canary yellow Mercury, they had led them to a man whose name was Walter Osborne.
Walter, huh?
Yeah, he too had gone missing about the same time as Adolf.
Okay.
So, but there was another clue. In his life insurance plan, the beneficiary was a man named Joseph Corbett, who had a son, Joseph Corbett Jr. Now, this guy, he was apparently the one posing as a guy named Walter Osborne.
Okay, hold on. Let's break this down again. So Walter Osborne is actually Joseph Corbett's son.
An alias. Joseph Corbett's son.
Car had been... Okay, I think I got it. Okay,
so Joseph Corbett Jr. had a life insurance plan benefiting his father. Mm-hmm. He was posing as a guy named Walter Osborne.
That's
now,
so wild.
Yeah, what's interesting about this guy, too... Joseph Corbett Jr., he had already been convicted of a murder in California. He had shot an Air Force sergeant after they got into a little bit of an argument.
Yeah.
But he escaped prison.
How did you escape prison? Did he, like jump off the bus or, like, how did he...
I have no idea how he escaped prison, but he was a fugitive for escaping prison in California. So, after they find these remains, they broadcast his picture everywhere.
Yeah.
And some folks in Canada, coincidentally...
They're like, well, we know this guy.
They see it. And they're like,
George?
Hey, y'all, some guy with that same name was just renting my apartment over here. He moved, but you might want to find out where he went. And sure enough... They work with the Mounties and another lady in Winnipeg. She calls them the Mounties, and she's like, look, this dude just looks like the guy who stayed at my flop house.
Wow, okay.
And
so
a
they
flop
start
house,
following this trail with the Mounties and, like, tracking him down?
Yeah, and also, flop house is the greatest word of all time.
Flop house. What is a flop house,
It's
actually?
A cheap hotel or rooming house, so it's basically a motel. I would rather stay
hotel
in a flop house, personally.
Floppity inn. Okay, yeah. Flop house. Gotcha. I'm getting smarter every day with you.
So she tells him, she's like, look, I just saw this dude. He looks like that guy, but the car he's driving is a red Pontiac.
Oh, did he paint it or swap it?
So they had previously actually found the canary yellow Mercury on fire somewhere in the Northeast.
Fire. This so, car is on fire. In the Northeast,
in
you
the
say?
Northeast.
Okay, wow.
So somehow
okay.
he got... He's just Northeast into Canada.
Some land. Yep.
So what the police and the Mounties do, they trace that car down, and eventually they found Joseph Corbett Jr.
Wow. He led him on a pretty decent little chase.
Yeah. I mean, but to be fair, it was like less than a year because he was sentenced to life in prison in 1961.
Okay. Okay.
Obviously, he married the heir to a beverage powerhouse. So, yeah, that's probably the treatment that you get.
Wait, so he was going around murdering heirs even though he was married to an heir?
Mm-mm. He was just a random dude.
Oh, okay.
He was
okay.
a random dude who kidnapped the Adolf Coors III
gotcha.
In hopes for money, but
gotcha.
Obviously something went wrong.
Yeah.
He ends
probably
up killing mildy. Him.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know those Coors boys.
Yeah. So ended up killing him. Okay. Gotcha. Wow.
And that, again, happened in 1960. So he was sentenced to prison in 1961.
Okay.
Interestingly, Corbett, has always maintained he is innocent.
Mm.
But when the police found him in Canada, he allegedly said, quote, I'm your man.
Mm.
He okay. also eventually did get out of prison.
Okay.
And he died in 2009 at the age of 80 from a gunshot wound to his own head.
Oh, wow. Tragic end. Many deaths
yes.
were had here.
So that's why I'm drinking dead guy ale, because there were multiple dead guys in my story
yeah.
today.
Wow, that's so...
Such a pick-me-up.
Yeah, that's so heavy. So, okay.
I'm sorry. How can we end this on a lighter note?
No,
I'll cheer
so
to that.
Yeah. Well, okay. So was he released from prison, or did he just serve all of his
No, he was
time?
Released for...
Or escape, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, he was released on probation.
Wow.
Basically.
That is quite the tale.
I know. Can you believe that happened to one of the most famous American families of all time?
I find it more shocking that kidnapping was just so in vogue. Like, that's so... crazy to me, but I mean, it happens even around the world right now. It's mm-hmm. a thing that people do for money.
You
it's
hold.
Like, when has it ever worked?
I mean, a lot of times,
lots of times
actually.
I'm
I think
sure.
sometimes
yeah.
families are just like, whatever. Here's $100,000. Let's get them back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even I was watching Narcos Mexico, and I feel like one of the rich daughters dating one of the Narcos guys. Like they kind of played her family like that. So. Anyways.
All cheers to that.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I really liked this true crime series. I look forward to researching more true crime
yeah.
with you in the future. This was neat.
Definitely.
Cheers, girl.
Definitely want to, like, look into Al Capone and all his experience.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on Patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
Cheers.
What you drinking?